I always felt that you can do whatever you want to do. Mm-hmm. It's just this ego or the society that holds you back from fulfilling your mission and your dharma. And I say, get up, do whatever you want to do. Success is great, and failure is great too. Mm-hmm. So there's no difference for me. If you succeed in something, that's wonderful. If you fail, you get up the next day, okay, next.
Hello and welcome to Curious Ones podcast by Andara. Welcome back to those who have been here before. For those who are new, I am Yael Ginsberg, the host of the podcast. I'm a yoga teacher and spiritual coach and an all-around lover of philosophy and spirituality. Each week, we will hear eye-opening interviews with the teachers of the Andara Yoga Institute and the different teachers that pass through here. This life-changing knowledge shared through authentic, heartfelt communication is meant to help you live a happier, more fulfilled, and connected life. This week, I wanted to try something new by recording a little bit of an intro just so that I can put more of an emphasis on the different teachings from the episode, things to look out for, things to notice in the subtleties of what I spoke about with my guests. So this week on the podcast, I had the honor of hosting Sridhar Silberfein, who is a super interesting person, the founder of Bhakti Fest, a world-renowned festival that people come from all over the world to see the different teachers and world thought leaders that have come to this event year after year, including Deepak Chopra, Ram Dass, Radhanath Swami, Krishna Das, and many, many more. So getting into the conversation, it's really about the journey of entrepreneurship and trust and authenticity that led Sridhar to make really meaningful connections with these spiritual leaders and thinkers. His refreshing attitude that basically anything is possible and that no failure is really a cause to be a setback or a reason to stop, but more of a lesson and more of a game, that he brings a lot of playfulness to his entrepreneurship. He has ventures in many different fields that he did over the years. And really the through line throughout all of them was conscious business and trying to add some good value to the world, but also this ease that he did all these businesses with of really, as I said, this playfulness to try something and see if it works, if it doesn't work, to try something else, not to listen to other people's opinion, not to let other people discourage you from what you're trying to do or what you want to do. And a lot of thoughts about really letting unconditional love and trust be his guide and motivation. So I hope you guys get a lot of benefit from this episode. I hope you enjoy. And as always, I'll say that if you got any inspiration, any insight from this episode, please let us know, share with loved ones, help us spread this message, help support us, and keep this project going. So thank you so much for listening. It's an honor for us for you to lend us your ears and your time. We take that super seriously, and we just want to thank you from the bottom of our hearts. So let's get into the episode. I'm so happy to have our guest today, Sridhar Silberfein. Sridhar is a entrepreneur and event producer and the founder of Bhakti Fest, which is here this week hosting a retreat. He is also a Hatha yoga teacher. He studied philosophy and kirtan with Swami Satyananda and many great teachers and gurus around the world. He's also the creator of the first natural food store, an organic cosmetics company. He produced 2 movies and much, much more. So thank you for being on the podcast, Sridhar.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
It's my pleasure. Mm-hmm. Let's start with that. You created so many different things in, they're all conscious, but in very different areas. So what inspired you to go to these different areas?
Well, from an early age, I really was very inquisitive, and I had to book a lot of institutional things in the 60s and 70s and things like that. But I realized that there was way more to life than what my parents taught me or my siblings taught me or the school was teaching me. And I started getting out and starting exploring on my own. And for example, I started reading about vegetarianism at an early age. So what do? I go to a factory that slaughters a slaughterhouse on the guise that we were going to buy the place. And so when I went through there and I saw this conditions of animals, this is in the 60s, and I realized that wasn't going to be for me. And then that's when I became a vegetarian. Very early on. I was very young at the time. And, you know, but I stood on many platforms also trying to talk to people about these various aspects of life and stuff like that. But then I realized much later, and everybody gets it at the time that they get it. You can't push and you can't change and you can't cajole. Everyone will get it when they're ready. And if they don't get it, they'll come around another time to get it again or not.
Yeah, that's so true. I feel like I experience that a lot because I try to be as conscious as I am to my footprint in the world. And I notice, like, I was just with my family last week and I feel like such a preacher. I'm like, don't use plastic bottles. Why are you using plastic cups? And, you know, but it's not that easy because people are kind of set in their ways and it's easy to create, what is this word? Like antagonism.
Yeah, and the thing with family especially is that is the most difficult, you know. Like you might be a big time meditator and a yogi and this and that. Spend a weekend with your family and then see how you are afterwards.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And the thing is, I had the biggest problems with my family because, of course, I rebelled at a very early age. And I had a female guru also over the years. And I used to call her the mother. Mm-hmm. I still do.
Ama.
And but when every time I was with my regular mother, she would scream and yell at me, "Don't ever call anyone your mother. I'm your mother." And then, and you know, she didn't understand the esoteric meaning of calling someone mother. Mm. But I realized that for her, she was right. So I respected that. And the thing is, you might be understanding some new things, but it's not right for us to like push and push and push other people, especially our family. It really doesn't work well, and it just pushes, you know, creates a schism between our fathers and mothers and siblings and us, and it's not necessary. The best thing I found is to just be with them and love them and nurture them and let yourself be the example.
Yeah.
You know, if you're eating a certain way, or you're not using this, or you're not using that, or you're not drinking coffee, you're not smoking, whatever it is, they'll see that. Mm-hmm. They can't miss it, you know?
Right.
And they'll come around when they come around, if they do.
Yeah, I find it useful also to kind of put the information out there without saying how to do it, you know, like, or that they should do it.
I think we can't push people.
Yeah.
You know, I see that in relationships all the time. You know, between male, female, male, male, whatever the situation is, everybody's batting heads with each other. And that's because I want to change you, you want to change me, I want to change. You're never going to win that way. No one's changing anybody. Mm-hmm. You're changing yourself. And but people don't get that because the ego is so dominant and so strong in our beings and controls us so much that I want you to do what I'm doing. If I'm doing yoga, I want you to do yoga. If I'm eating this way, I want you to eat this way. Mm-hmm. If I want to do this, like that. Boss, you can't be doing that anymore. You can't be. And that just breaks up the relationships. Because
so
it only as, again, antagonism towards each other, stop doing this, stop doing that, then it folds. Mm-hmm. And then you continue to do that in all the relationships, because everybody is not happy with their own self. If you are happy with your own self and content within your own being, you don't have to change anybody. And that person will see the beauty in you, and they're going to say, oh, I want some of that. Mm-hmm. You know, that's fantastic, the way you're doing that, or the way you're eating with that, and those books you're reading and stuff like that. Yeah, hey, I want to share that.
Yeah.
And it's a much easier way to do it.
That's so interesting that it's really about kind of a place of lack within us that is causing us to want to change somebody else.
Yeah.
But then when we actually do it, it just ends up pushing them further away.
Exactly. And when you got to become strong inside yourself. Otherwise, you're BSing everybody else, because you're trying to change somebody and you don't even know what the change is. Mm. You know? You're being a phony about the change within yourself, mm-hmm. because you're not really totally dedicated to that change, you know? So once you're totally dedicated to a path, that's why I always emphasize having a practice. It's very important having a practice. And without a practice, this COVID situation for the last 3 years would have been very difficult for me. Mm-hmm. But I always maintain a practice of meditation, of yoga, of listening to chanting music, of reading spiritual books. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like I always say, what's on your bedside table, you know?
Yeah.
And then everybody says, oh, this is that. But you always need a couple of good books. And you don't have to read a book from cover to cover. It's good to extrapolate a couple of things from each book.
Yeah.
I have a huge library. I'm not saying I read everything, mm-hmm. but I pick up a book, I read a couple of pages or chapters, and I get something and I crack it, you know?
Yeah.
I understand it more.
What's on your bedside table?
Well, I'm very big on Manly Hall, mm-hmm. one of the great philosophers of all time. Of course, I'm always reading Ram Dass and I'm always reading Amma. Mm-hmm. Right.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, these are people that you know personally.
Yes, very much so.
Yes, I mean, you have... Yeah. Very, very interesting history. We haven't touched upon it yet, but let's go there. So you started your... Please tell us about how you started in this spiritual path.
Well, it's in the early 60s, I was just graduating college, and it was a waste of time, actually. I spent 5 years in college. It was, like, brutally stupid. And once I got out, I wanted to get out into the world and travel the world. But an aunt of mine said, why don't you come into, this was in New York City, said, come and see this meditation teacher by the name of Rudy. And I said, okay, I'll stop by. So I stopped by one of his classes. He was the biggest importer of Oriental arts and antiques in the world. And he was a very powerful teacher. Meditation teacher, because he was able to transmit Shaktipat. But I didn't know anything about Shaktipat, know what it is. And Shaktipat is transferring the energy by raising up the Kundalini and like that.
Transferring energy to the students from the guru, teacher?
Mm. He never really thought himself as the guru. He thought himself as a teacher. So he would sit on a little raised platform and there would be the students sitting in the class, but there would be big framed pictures of these great masters in India. Some of them, Bhagawan Nityananda from Ganeshpuri, who was one of the greatest beings ever came across. And he lived in a loincloth for 35 years in Ganeshpuri, which is outside of Mumbai. And Swami Muktananda was his main disciple who took over his lineage. But Rudy in the 50s happened to have met Bhagawan Nityananda. It was very rare that you found any Western person that met a great master like this. Mm-hmm. These are realized beings we're talking about. You know, when we talk about realized beings, we're not talking about the regular teacher that you find in a yoga class, mm-hmm. or even in a meditation class, you know, and certainly not here in America or in Europe. There are no people like that. Mm-hmm. You know, these are what came about in the olden days. I would say one of the few realized beings on the planet today would be Amma, the hugging saint, Mata Amritananda.
Yeah.
But when I went into the class, And I sat down for meditation. It was an open eye meditation. So he would gaze at you, and then he would gaze at the next person like that, and you would feel a presence. But as he gazed at me, I looked up and I saw this big, huge floor-to-ceiling picture of Bhagavan Nityananda. And I just went right out. I didn't understand what it was. I went very, very deep. And I didn't, you know, I wasn't doing any practice at that time. Nothing. I wasn't doing yoga. I wasn't doing anything. It was my first moment there. Then I left.
Where did you go?
I started my journey around the world. Mm-hmm. Right? I went out to California my first time, raced motorcycles, smuggled. I was a smuggler for a while. And, you know, that part of my story most people don't know. Then I wound up in a Spanish prison for a while.
Escaped from there.
Right. I escaped from a prison in Spain under a dictator of Francisco Franco. There's a big story about that. We don't have time right now. Some other time. And but one of the things that saved me in the prison, I tell you, just a short little snippet. I was in solitary confinement for like 2 weeks. No shower, no toilet, no bathroom, nothing. And a little bit of food thrown in my room. Mm-hmm. And I would be laying on springs, but there was a very thin little thing. But it was full of these bugs that got all over my body and got into my skin, you know, but underneath my skin. And I was scratching myself to death. And I was full of these very bad sores. And then I said, my name was Stephen back then. I didn't have a spiritual name. I said, either you're going to go deeper right now and understand that by you scratching, you're going to die. And then a vision of that picture of Bhagavan Nityananda that I had seen came to me. And then I got right into my deepest meditation. I didn't even know what it was, but that was the start of my meditation. And then I stopped scratching, and then eventually everything transpired after that.
Yeah.
But it was that moment that brought me to a very deep state. And only when you go to that deep state can you release these outside attachments and these problems that we have. Otherwise, we're just hanging out, doing the same repetitive stuff all the time.
Unconsciously.
Yeah, unconsciously. And we think we're getting anywhere. So I like to tell people there's no enlightenment in this lifetime. We're not getting enlightened. We're just trying to be nice, good people.
Yeah.
And at the end of the day, that's all that counts, you know? Mm-hmm. Leave the enlightenment for other situations that people think they're going to get, but like that, you know?
I think most people are just looking to feel better because so many of the practices today make us feel worse, and so much of how our society is run and just the way it functions makes us feel worse about ourselves and disconnected.
Right.
And that's why people are so drawn to yoga and kirtan and festivals and retreats like this one, that because they are able to glimpse these moments of clarity and of deeper knowledge.
You know, back then we didn't have technology. Mm-hmm. We didn't have cell phones. We didn't have computers. So in 1965, when I moved back to New York, and I was living there for 5 years and studying with Rudy, my yoga guru came to America in like 1967, Swami Satchidananda. I started studying with him, my yoga. But the practices that he brought were very different than the practices today. There was no music. Mm-hmm. It was very strict, very strict. And a lot of internal practices where we'd have to stick the string up our nose and out our mouth and drink a couple of gallons of water move it around and throw it all up. And these kind of ancient stuff that hardly ever see practiced.
Yeah, it's part of the practice of yoga, but it's not very common at all. Yeah,
not at all. And if it is, it's usually taught by people that really don't understand the mechanics of it. We're blessed this weekend to have Yog Rishi here from Rishikesh, who does practice all those things.
Oh, wow.
And that's what attracted me to him, and that's why I became close to him. And then I started, you know, I really wanted to enhance my practice and go deeper, and I became, you know, the top yoga teacher of his group at 500 Western Avenue. And I was also hanging around with the creators and producers of Woodstock.
Yeah, that was my next question. Maybe you can tell us a little bit about your relationship with them, your experience there. I know there's a beautiful story with Swami Satchinanda.
Yeah. Most of these stories are very long, but I'm going to give you this short recap. So I was hanging out with Michael Lang and Artie Kornfeld. They were the original producers of Woodstock. And, you know, we did the normal things that people do in the 60s, smoking and hanging out. And one day they said, Sridhar, what do you think is missing from the future of Woodstock? I said, well, you got all these great musicians coming, or to be great musicians, because most of them nobody knew about. And everything else was organized, but you're missing the spiritual aspect. They said, really? What do you mean by that? I said, we should have a Swami come and do the invocation. They thought for a minute, and they said, okay, why didn't you produce that? You probably didn't think I was going to. So I went back and I sat down with Swami Satchinanda, and I said, Swami, this is a great idea. So then they said, okay. And the rest of this you actually see in the movie of Woodstock in the director's cut, how we flew him into on a helicopter because all the roads were blocked for days. And he landed, and eventually we brought him up on the stage. And funny, because the first group that was supposed to go on in Woodstock got on stage, and they were so frightened, they jumped off the stage, and they ran in the bushes and hid. So they looked around, they got Richie Havens, and he came up, and he was like sweating, because Richie always sweated a lot like that. So Richie sweated a lot, and he's tuning up, and we come walking on the stage. You actually see me walking Swami up on the stage in the movie. And I realized that there was nobody there to announce Swami Satchinanda. So me, in my wisdom, says to Richie, oh, Richie, do you mind introducing Swami Satchinanda? And he looked at me and says, get the F away from me. You know, this, it was such a hilarious thing. Yeah. Eventually, finally, we got the original announcer to announce, and he gave this most beautiful invocation in front of 500,000 people. You see it. It's a very famous picture and video. It's all over the world. And then we stood in the back of the stage for a few minutes after he was finished, and he said to me, I said to him, Swami, someday we're going to have this many people chanting the divine names. And he said, oh, Sridhar, I hope so. And then 40 years later, pretty much almost to the day, we started with Bhakti Fest in 2009. So it was a very interesting transition. Of course, we didn't have 500,000 people, but it doesn't matter. Numbers aren't important. The exact number of people come at all times, and those are the people that are going to get it. Yeah. You know, most of the time we do projects, we try to think of how many more numbers that we can get. But I keep saying it's not about the numbers, it's about. And that brings me back to a great story. When I hosted Amma, the Hugging Saint, at my home in Topanga Canyon, California, for 17 years. And the first year she came, I think it was 1988. I've been with her for like 35 years. And she walks into the house and went right into the room that we built for her. And then I had around 50, 60 people. And we were waiting hours and hours and hours and hours, and she wouldn't come out. Everybody kept saying to me, what's going on? You know, we want to see her. I said, I don't really know. I just met her. You know, I don't know her routine and stuff. But anyhow, most of the people left, and it was only like 15 people left in the room. For her first time in Los Angeles. And I, as she coming out, I said, oh, I'm so sorry. There's only a few people here. No, oh, don't worry about it, Sridhar. Someday I'm going to have millions and millions of followers. And sure enough, she does.
I think that's really relevant to any yoga teachers that are listening to this, because it's so common, especially when you're starting out. You know, maybe sometimes there's five people that show up, or even less than that. And it's easy to get discouraged because of that. I remember
when I was starting out, and you know, still, you know, the numbers vary all the time. But as you said, the thing that always helped me kind of manage that internally was to understand that whoever needs to receive what I have to give in that day will be there.
And don't be discouraged about anything. You're doing a service, you know, and you're coming from a pure heart. And that's the most important thing. Mm-hmm. See, yoga has become a very big business.
Right.
You know, over the years, it's just everyone's, you know, becoming a yoga teacher or a massage therapist. And it's all basically they have nothing to do in their lives. So they take a teacher training course and they became a yoga teacher. And then they get discouraged because nobody's coming or they don't have any foundation of real deep spirituality. Mm. I find the majority of teachers do not really understand the depth of what the work is and the commitment mm-hmm. to the work.
Yeah. I mean, I think you need to study for many, many, many years.
Many years, your whole life.
Yeah.
It's always a study. I'm still studying.
Yeah.
You know, I study all the time. I take classes with a lot of teachers still. Mm-hmm. I don't have to, but I want to always open because everything changes in life.
Right.
What you're experiencing now at a certain age, at another age, it'll be different. And at another age, it'll be different. And at another age, it'll be different. It's like reading the same book over and over every 5 or 10 years. Mm-hmm. Oh, I didn't even know it said that.
Yes, because you're reading it from like a different place internally.
Depending on where you're at the time.
Definitely, definitely. Hey, I'm quickly interrupting the episode to extend an invitation. If you are interested in deepening into any of the subjects we talk about on the podcast, we offer many different experiences on our beautiful grounds here in Baja, Mexico. From 9-day modules such as sound healing and yoga nidra, to breath and meditation, as well as 200 or 300 hour yoga teacher trainings, and many different shorter retreats. Check out our website, yandara.com, to see all the information about the different experiences. Let's get back to the episode. So I would love to ask you about that, those 40 years between that conversation with Swami Satchinanda and making a prediction about gathering people to chant together consciously. So 40 years passed, and I find that so interesting because it was, as I see it, there is a natural process that things need in order to evolve, like we just mentioned about the internal evolution. So could you share a little bit about what was it within you that needed to develop in order to be able to really start this amazing project? And now 12 years in, right, we see how many people it has affected. Of course, you bring world famous teachers and gurus, Ram Dass.
Everybody. Yeah. That's anybody in the yoga scene has been to the festivals. But segueing within that, 1970, my first guru came into the country, and that was Baba Muktananda, Swami Muktananda, who was direct lineage from Bhagavan Nityananda. And I was part of his original team, and that's how he came in Labor Day weekend, 1970, and we had a big retreat upstate New York. Again, only like around 100 people. And Ram Dass was there, and some Hilda Charlton, a great woman saint from New York, psychic, and a number of other swamis. And he turned around to me one day, and a few of us got a chance to sleep in his bedroom on the floor. And he was a very super powerful guy. Mm. You know, he was able to transform you in just by a look or a glance or a hit or hit with the feathers and stuff like that, or a word. And he turned to Ram Dass and me and he said, I want you two to organize my tour around the country. And I look at him, I didn't know who Ram Dass was, and he of course didn't know I had my name by then, Sridhar. And we became fast friends at that point, and we maintained that relationship until he left his body in 2019. In fact, he used to come out. So we moved to Topanga in 1970, Topanga, California. We started an ashram there and called the Center for Spiritual Studies, mm-hmm. which is open to all teachings. So out the 70s, 80s, 90s, all the people that came from India, They're all new. You come to LA, you come to the Center for Spiritual Studies, they would get the most people out for your programs, mm-hmm. right? So everyone from Yogi Bhajan to Swami Satchinanda was there, and Muktananda was there, and Amma was there, and so many, maybe hundreds of other teachers. And Krishna Das and Bhagawan Das and Jayutal. No, Deepak wasn't part of that, but Jayutal and all that lineage. And all the kirtan singers, Dave String, everybody got really their start up there. Because we would have, every weekend we would have a different kirtan, but nobody really understood what kirtan and chanting was in the 70s. So, in fact, we sometimes got death threats from neighbors threatening to bomb our place because of this noise that they were saying we were hearing. You know? It was like...
Which is singing. Yeah. Basically,
yeah, it was just singing, but singing like kirtan singing is similar to what you do when you go to a Catholic church or a Christian church and you sing, you know, or when you go to a Jewish synagogue.
Yeah, but singing. I would say that it's less religious, isn't it?
Yeah, but it's all subjective, right? You know, if you're chanting Hare Krishna, you're chanting to Krishna. There is a connotation of a religion there, you know, right? The Krishna consciousness, the movement. So it all depends on how you interpret it inside yourself and where you're going with it. So when I'm chanting Hare Krishna, the Maha Mantra, I'm not thinking about a movement or a religion or anything like that. I'm just feeling that fantastic energy and that love coming from the Maha Mantra.
Yeah, it's undeniable, definitely.
Yeah. So throughout those years, that's how it all continued. And we started to put on retreats, and I did all the retreats for Ram Dass. And then, so it was natural that what was the next step? And that's how in 2008, we decided just let's have a gathering and get people together, and we'll do some yoga and chant and have some workshops. And it just evolved from that.
Do you feel that it was a certain skill, a certain level of confidence? What was it inside of you in terms of your abilities that was that meant for you that now you're ready to do that?
Well, I started a lot of businesses in between. As I said, I started the first natural food store in Southern California, created a cosmetic company called Desert Essence, and I had a lot of other entrepreneurial activities. And I always felt that you can do whatever you want to do. It's just this ego or the society that holds you back from fulfilling your mission and your dharma. And I say, get up, do whatever you want to do. Success is great and failure is great too. So there's no difference for me. If you succeed in something, that's wonderful. If you fail, you get up the next day. Okay, next.
You get up smarter.
Yeah, you don't get into a depression. You don't get into a mode that I can't do anything in. Stay in the bed all the time with the pillow over your head. It's no necessary. You know, you just get up. Okay, that didn't work. Let's do this. Let's do that. Let's do this. Let's do that. And you keep going. You can't be discouraged. And you can't let other people. See, other people tend to discourage us, right?
Yeah.
You come up with
at least a fear of what other people think or say.
But you don't need to worry about any. Nobody needs to worry about any of what if somebody else is. I never worry and concern myself with other people. You like me, fantastic. You don't like me, it's fantastic. It doesn't matter to me. You know, I know in my heart of hearts that I'm doing the right thing. And when you do that, when you get to that state, then nothing, everyone's basically very jealous of each other, right? So especially friends. So if they see you successful and you're doing something, they will probably pull you into another space or try to pull you down because they're not at that level yet.
Yeah, they instead, think it says more about them, something about them, your success. Yeah.
Instead of encouraging all that. Every time I see people successful, I am so happy for them. I hug them and love them up and I'm so happy. And people come to me, oh, I'm so depressed and I'm so, I said, please, don't tell me any of that. Tell me how happy you are.
Yeah.
You know?
Definitely. Right. I heard a very smart, interesting story about this, about some guy that had like a hedge fund or something like that. And then one of his employees lost $1 million. And someone asked him, Okay, are you going to fire him now? He lost you $1 million. And he said, are you crazy? I just invested $1 million in him.
Exactly. Yeah. That's a very good way to look at it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so don't be discouraged. You know, get out there, wake up every day. You have an idea. There's millions of ideas and millions of things to do. And I always encourage younger people. That's why I love working with my daughter, Bella.
Mm. Oh, yeah. She's amazing. She's been on the podcast as well.
She's fantastic. We lived together for the last 6 years, and we work together. And it's an example of how a father and a daughter can really connect and work on the same levels with each other. And we have arguments, of course. It's not like always everything's like 100% sweet, but we work it through.
Yeah.
You know, my ideas are very advanced and very extreme sometimes, and she's more quiet and settled, you know, and stuff like that. So it's good for me also.
Yeah, it's a good balance.
It's a very good balance because I love the youth. I love young people. Mm-hmm. I'm always encouraging young people. In fact, we have a couple here this weekend, Govindas and Radha, who you're going to interview. Yeah. When she first started out, Radha, she has an amazing voice, and she is such a goddess. She was always afraid to be out there in front of her. So one year at the festivals, I said, before the festival, I said, okay, Radha, I'm going to give you a woman's workshop. Oh, no, Shrita, I'm afraid. I don't want. I said, forget about it all. I pushed her to do a woman's workshop. She did it, and then she does women's workshops all the time.
Oh, wow.
Just because somebody was able to give that push.
That's so important.
And it doesn't normally come from the relationship that you're in. Because then it's looked at as a different thing.
Yeah, it's man, harder to listen.
Man is looking to push the woman, or the woman is looking to push the man, or whatever the relationship is. It's always looked at as something else. Mm-hmm. But if somebody else that has no vested interest just sees the potential in somebody and is encouraging it, you encourage that person to fulfill who they really are.
Yeah, so if anybody's listening and you're in a position to do that, that's an amazing thing to do.
Absolutely.
That happened to me as well. My first yoga class that I got at a studio, I was so nervous that the night before, like a few days before, I texted the owner of the studio and I told him, sorry, I can't do it. I'm not ready. And luckily, he insisted that I do it.
Right.
And, well, I've been teaching ever since.
Everybody has basically a fear of getting up in front of people and teaching and, you know, like that. But who cares? Mm-hmm. I sometimes mumble and stumble my words. I don't get it correct. I forget somebody and not being able to introduce, or I forget somebody. It just happened the Sunday night here. I forgot to introduce a couple of people, but later on in the evening program, I remembered to do it. So, the thing is not to be discouraged. I don't think you should ask anybody for their opinions on stuff. I really don't. Because everybody, you know, opinions are like assholes. Everybody has an opinion, right? Yeah. And like, you know, you get too confused if you ask everybody, oh, what you thinking on this? What you feeling? Go for it.
You get affected by their opinion, and that kind of clouds your clear vision of what you were imagining.
I tell you a quick story about that. Yeah. When I had my health food store in Topanga, it was in 1975, 78, these two men came in suits. Very strange to see a man in suits in my community, because it was a hippie. Topanga Canyon was known as the hippie culture of the 70s and the 60s.
Still is.
And they said, we're really watching what you're doing here. We admire you. We want to give you the West Coast distribution of these products. I said, oh, okay, what are they? Avion water, Apollinaris water, Mountain Valley water, four or five different waters in bottles that they wanted to give me the West Coast distribution exclusive for $50,000. Yeah. I didn't have the $50,000, but I called my dad in New York. I said, Pops, you know, I got this, this, and this. And he's, you know, the phone went dead. I thought he hung up on me. And then he comes back and says, who's going to drink water out of a bottle?
And here we are today.
Right.
Yeah. What did you end up doing?
Well, nothing. I didn't have the money to do it.
Yeah.
And that became the biggest water companies in the world.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Well,
that taught me that moment. Mm-hmm. I said, okay, I'm not going to anybody for anything anymore. Mm. I'm just going to do, I'll come up with whatever I need to come up with. I'll get the money, so I'll have to do whatever I do.
Yeah.
And that's how I worked.
Interesting lesson in that.
Yeah.
I feel like it's, so where do you find the balance though? Because sometimes it is important to get feedback or advice, maybe from a mentor, an elder. Where do you find the balance there?
I think it's very important to, you know, from an early age, I said, I want to hang out with teachers and spiritual people that know more than me.
Mm.
Not that knows the same as me or not less than me. I said, what's the point of wasting my time? So I've always seeked out spiritual teachers, and those were my balances. I'm fortunate, very fortunate, to have some of the great teachers that are still alive today and that have passed away, that are still very close to me, that I'm in regular communication with. And basically whenever I, you know, if I'm having anything, I'm usually not anymore, but if I did or have in the past, I would seek out those guidances. Mm-hmm. You know, I spent so many years with Ram Dass that in 2009, I got together with him and we started a interview program.
Yeah.
And we did 12 interviews.
Once a year
yeah. In April, I would go to Maui and I would sit down. We'd have three cameras and no holds bar.
Mm-hmm.
That was our agreement in the beginning. We can ask and talk about anything, sex, this, that, whatever, you know. And we did. And we went sometimes down 2 hours on a session. They're all up on YouTube. Ram Dass and Conversations of Spiritual.
Yeah, they're wonderful. I watched a few.
Yeah, they're fantastic. And just to see his answers and my abilities to interview him, I didn't do it before. Here's another example of just getting an idea and saying, okay, fine, let's do it.
Yeah.
And we did it, and I fumbled through the first couple of ones, you know, and you know, forgot my lines or what were supposed to be lines, but they're not really lines. And he never asked me what the questions were before.
Mm-hmm.
It was always what came to him at that time.
Yeah. Yeah. So there was two things that I want to speak about. So one of them is really an important lesson here about starting before you're ready, right? Because whenever we want to do something that's above the level we're at that moment, it feels like we're not ready, but it seems like you had this ability to start before you were ready, and kind of do it, even though I'm sure that there was some sort of hesitation there.
Yeah, because I realized, what's ready?
Mm.
When are you going to be fully baked to do things? You're not. It takes many, many years, many years to get even half baked. Right? That oven stays on for many, many years.
Yeah.
Really? It's just a temperature change.
Yeah.
Right? So sure. You know, I certainly wasn't ready, but I did it. And I just eased into it.
And really the only way to get ready is by doing it.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, like I came up with an idea in 1998. Oh, I want to do a movie on Amma's life story. Have you done any movies? No. Do you know anything about movie making? No.
Wow.
And I said, okay. I went out and I found the number one documentary maker in the whole country by the name of Michael Tobias. And then I started looking at all his documentaries. I said, oh my God, this guy will never come. Took a meeting with him and I showed him some old vintage footage of Amma. And he wasn't even paying attention to me and my wife at the time when we were talking to him. He was just watching those. And normally gets $100,000 to direct a movie. He agreed to come on for $10,000.
Wow.
Right? And we found a crew in Bombay. And people said, okay, you can come. We'll give you 11 days to shoot this movie. And that's it. They didn't even think I would be able to do it. And I didn't even have the money to do it. I put $35,000 on a couple of credit cards.
Wow.
And I went there with Michael and we shot this amazing, amazing movie. It's called River of Love. Mm-hmm. It's up on YouTube, also on our channel, bhaktifest.com. And it turned out absolutely incredible. The first part is docudrama of her life story with actors and actresses that never even saw a camera in India. We had to cast them from the ashram, three of them to play Amma at different ages, right? Which is very crazy, right? And then it was just a very intense period of time shooting this and having the schedule of 11 days and then doing it and then coming back and then going through the editing process. And Michael Tobias had a different vision of what it should be. And we didn't get along at that point. So I had to fire him.
Wow.
Me firing this major name as a director.
Yeah.
And I wound up hiring an editor and supervising the editing and getting it done the right way. Yeah. And it raised around $300,000 for Amma's charitable projects.
Wow.
Did I get my $35,000 back, you ask? No.
No.
Because I wasn't interested in getting that back, and it was not part of my whole thing, which is the reason why the success was there, because you're putting it out and you're not looking for anything in return. And that's what true seva, S-E-V-A, which means service, that's the true way to do these things. You just do seva, you take care of people, you serve, you love everybody, do work, continue to do work, and never look for anything in return. Not even a nod, not even a blink, not even a pat on the back. That's true seva.
Wow, so it sounds like an amazing journey. It sounds like you, I mean, first of all, the part of seva is incredible. I think it's maybe something that we can aspire to.
Yes,
it's
absolutely.
It's hard to.
It's very hard to because, you know, we always are needing some self-gratification, and we are looking for pats on the back, and it's very difficult, you know. And I see myself falling into that trap a lot, but then I sit back and say, no. In my prayers, I say, please don't let me have any attachment to this project or anything like that. Let it come from a pure place, you know. So you need to check yourself. You need to keep on feeling that.
Yeah.
And you don't want, you know, grace is there. Once you're graced by being around the great gurus, which we all have the opportunity to be, your life will be blessed and you'll live a graceful life.
So actually letting the intention infuse what you're doing and having this kind of trust that you'll be supported.
You absolutely will be supportive. And that's why it's so important to have teachers and spiritual gurus in your life. I'm a firm believer of the guru-disciple relationship. I've always been that way for the last 50 years, and I've always seeked out to be with many, many teachers and many spiritual gurus. Right? I can only say I had two gurus in my life. Most people don't even have one.
Yeah, that's true. So going back to these conversations that you had with Ram Dass over 12 years, what would be one of the biggest things that you feel like you learned from that?
Well, I'm always learning from Baba. You know, he's taught me so much over the years, you know, surrender and how to love deeper without attachment, you know. This thing about unconditional love, we always have conditions on our love with each other, right? Oh, if you do it this way and you do this and you do that, I'm going to love you. But if you don't do this, you know, I'm going to withhold my love. What he actually taught me a lot was unconditional love. You know, just love each other unconditionally without wanting anything in return. That's the key here.
Yeah.
You know, we're always wanting something from somebody else. There's always a caveat to our love.
Right.
But unconditional love is this very deep and high state. It's a beautiful state. It's to dwell in that place, which comes and goes. We can't necessarily be in that space all the time. But coming and going is fine for me.
Yes, definitely. At least dwelling there part-time.
That's right.
Beautiful. So you've really spent a lot of time with very interesting people. And it seems like that's been true throughout your whole process, your whole life, since you kind of started in the 70s.
Do you attribute that to a certain quality that you have, something inside you, or is it something that you cultivated?
Well, as I said before, I did want to spend as much time with other higher beings, right? So that I became close with Tim Leary and Lawrence Ferlinghelli and Allen Ginsberg
yeah.
and all these people. They were contemporaries of mine, and Salvador Dali.
Wow.
I spent time with him. So wherever it took me, I went.
Yeah,
I wasn't ever inhibited. I would just go in there and become friends with everybody, you know, just through what I had brought to the table as well.
Yeah.
Not just feeding off of them or, you know, because I always had stuff that I brought to the table also. You know, I was an established yoga teacher at that time, and I would help other people with diet and food and stuff like that. That's how it just evolved, and it kept on going, you know. And then you start weaving around and seeing who you really want to spend time with.
Yeah.
Instead of lots of people, you start narrowing it down to people that are more nourishing for you and more have the ability to give you what you need. We all need the same thing. It's basically we need love, you know, love and support, kindness, you know. That's what human nature is all about. And when we don't have it, we get sad and depressed and go through all these kind of down periods.
Yeah.
You know,
look for it outside.
Yeah. Look for it outside. Look through it through stimuluses. And that doesn't happen either.
Right.
This is all, everything is temporary. Everything is temporary. Comes, goes, comes, goes, comes, goes.
I found it so interesting this morning. Govindas was speaking about the three gurus that we have. I don't know if I'm going to say it correctly. The creator, the sustainer, and the destroyer.
Right.
And I found it so interesting that we were chanting for the destroyer as well as being one of the gurus, which is so interesting that even in the destruction, in the whole cycle, there is a teaching.
Absolutely. That's the letting go of it.
Yeah. Beautiful.
That's the Shiva aspect, right? He just like takes that knife and cuts right through that bullshit. That's why I call my class on Thursday Cutting Through the Bullshit.
I love that. Well, we do need that sometimes.
That is, because we keep on bullshitting ourselves, and then we start thinking, oh, really? I'm doing this, I'm doing that, you know, I'm this, I'm that.
Yeah.
It doesn't work.
Beautiful. So we're going to move on to the closing curiosity questions.
Okay.
This, I end each
episode. Sounds like exciting stuff.
Okay. Yes. The first one is, what is something you've changed your mind about?
Relationships.
In what way?
I'm not really attached to relationships anymore. I spent a whole lifetime attached to women and relationships and stuff like that, and I got to a point that I was able to let go of that and just pretty self-reliant. You know, I travel the world pretty much by myself. Occasionally I have friends here and there, but I'm not dependent on anybody anymore.
What is something you didn't think you could do and you did? I feel like there's a lot.
Something that I couldn't do?
That you didn't think you could do and you did.
I don't think anything. I think everything I wanted to do, I just went out and did it.
Yeah.
Because again, I wasn't afraid of failure. So just get up and do whatever you want to do. Whatever comes to you, do it and take whatever the results are without attachment.
Amazing. What gives you hope?
Well, that's interesting, because the last 3 years have been very, very difficult in the world, you know?
Yeah.
And it's even more difficult now. I think youth gives me hope. I watch the young people. I watch my daughter. I watch the younger people. I have two beautiful grandchildren. I'm watching them, you know? The younger generation gives me some hope. If they stay off that technology, it gives me more hope. But the technology is really ruining everybody. I don't know. I'm still working on that.
Well, that's, I agree with that. I mean, I think That's the future.
It's scary, and I feel for a lot of people that are young. I'm already into my prime now, but I'm just here to help people, and whatever they need, I'm here for them.
Yeah, I wasn't planning to ask this, but I'm going to add a question. What is the most important thing you like to pass on to your children, your grandchildren?
How to be able to love each other without, you know, asking for anything in return. It's the most difficult thing that we have.
Yeah.
Right? And young people, they're just brought up with TV and the phones and the computers, and they're having such a hard time opening up their heart and loving and not being afraid of rejection. And, you know, we've all been hurt, and you will be hurt in your life. You'll continue to be hurt. Mm-hmm. That's because we're depending on other people for our happiness.
Yeah.
And once we let go of depending on other people for our happiness, we will find that contentment inside ourselves has nothing to do with anybody else.
Mm, I love that. Last question, what are you curious about right now?
What am I curious about? What's for dinner? No, I'm not really, I don't live a life of waking up and being curious. You know, I got a half a dozen nice projects that I'm working on. And I like doing that. And then again, I take off and I go down to Mexico for 4 or 5 months. And I swim every day. Mm-hmm. And I eat good food. And I do my practice. And I'm very happy. And I come back and everything's still there.
Beautiful. Would you like to share a little bit about those projects? How can people stay connected with you,
your work? Yes, stay connected through our bhaktifest.com. We're doing a bhakti yatra next year. It's January 26th to February 12th to India. And actually, I made a movie that was my second movie called Bhakti Yatra, Y-A-T-R-A. It's also up on YouTube. We're planning on doing a big bhakti festival in September of 2023.
A big one coming back.
Yeah, we're going to do a big event, and people have been... It's not a week or a day goes by that everybody's calling and asking when.
Yeah.
Then I'm supposed to be writing my memoirs. It's kind of difficult. Every time I sit down, it's just on a piece of envelope or a back of a page or something. It's very hard for me. I'd like to finish that sometime. And we've got two, three more retreats for next year as well. We have one coming up in November here with Shiva Ray and the Kirtaniyas.
Oh, wow.
And Michael Brian Baker. So if those who really would like to come, registration is going to be open soon to Bella. And we'll be back here in November.
Incredible. Sridhar, thank you so much. It was so fun.
Thank you so much. We had a good time. Let's do it again.
Now, after this time to nurture your mind and your spirit, we invite you to take a moment to consider others. A kind wish might come to mind. Know that what we learn becomes more valuable when we apply it and share it with others. So share this episode on Instagram stories, tag Yandara and I, or share with a loved one so that more people can benefit from it. Our hope is that the search will lead you home to who you already are, to what was always there. We'll be back next week with more inspiration, honest conversation, and insight into the energetic world around us. Thank you for listening and watching.